Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director of the Institute. Normally, at this point, I would introduce our speaker, but before I do that, we have something that you may be interested to watch. So let me ask my colleagues to play a short video before I introduce Peter. So there you go, a trailer for a book. Why didn't I think of that? That was a trailer for a new novel, Ghost War, which
Ghost
is
Fleet.
Ghost Fleet, I beg your pardon, about a potential war between the United States and China in the Pacific. And to discuss that novel and indeed the future of war, we have Peter Singer. Peter is a leading strategist. He's an old friend of mine. He's a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation, founder of the technology advisory firm Neo Luddite, the author of many award-winning non-fiction books. He's one of the world's leading experts on changes in 21st century warfare. Previously, he served as coordinator of the Obama campaign's Defense Policy Task Force in 2008. He's worked for the Office of the Secretary of Defense at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard. He was the founding director of the Center for 21st Century Security Intelligence at Brookings, and he holds a PhD from Harvard and a BA from Princeton. So it's a very long and distinguished and impressive biographer. And now to that list, we have to add novelist. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Peter Singer. Thank you. So my first question is apart from can you do the trailer for my next book, the Boyer Lectures, which will deal with some of the same themes, why did you decide to write a novel? I mean, you've explored a lot of these topics in nonfiction. Why did you decide to write a novel?
Well, first, I want to thank you and the Lowy Institute for hosting me. This is my first time here, and it is spectacular, and it's also really neat to just be here physically after following from afar via social media and the like. So the reason for a novel, there's multiple reasons. And the idea, when we say novel, it's actually a smash-up of two genres. So it's a novel, a techno-thriller in the style of a Tom Clancy or a Michael Crichton book. But it also has 400 endnotes in the style of a nonfiction book, documenting how every single technology in it, every single trend, even some of the things that the characters say are drawn from the real world. And the idea is something that we're calling useful fiction. So it can be entertaining, it can be exciting, it follows multiple characters, but also it can serve utility in a number of ways. And so with fiction, you can explore certain worlds that might lie ahead in rich detail. And that might be the big what if of what if there was a conflict between the US and China, or it might be micro level what ifs. So what if, for example, the joint strike fighter that the US and Australia and every essentially allied power is purchasing, what if it's not a what if it was hacked, because we've documented it's been hacked on at least three separate occasions. What are the consequences of it being hacked? How might that play out? That leads to a second thing that fiction can do. It can warn of certain dangers that lie ahead. The classic example of this would be Arthur Conan Doyle's 1914 story, Danger, that warned that, hey, this new thing that was once science fiction called submarines might be used in war, might matter against not just dreadnoughts, but might be used against civilian shipping. He wrote that before World War I. The British Admiralty made fun of him for this absurd idea that he should have stayed writing, Sherlock Holmes novels. Another thing fiction can do is can flesh out the human side in a way that's sometimes difficult in nonfiction. And that might be the human side of politics. It might even be sometimes you can say something in a couple of sentences in fiction that would take thousands of words in nonfiction. So one example is there's a scene in the book where two U.S. Navy officers in this future are talking about an upcoming shore leave, and one of them asks, they're both men, and asks, is John coming? Is your husband John coming? And he says, yeah, we're going to go surfing. And they move on with a conversation. And it's a quick way of showing that these huge debates over kind of the culture wars within the military that we went through in the U.S. with things like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we're past them, but also they won't matter in when there's a real war. The final reason for fiction is one of our models was Game of Thrones, so not following individual one character, but multiple characters. And the writer of Game of Thrones, George R. R. Martin, he said, all writers are readers first, and so they like to write books that they'd like to read. And I think that's, again, a lesson that's useful for both nonfiction and fiction. We too often forget it in our realm, and that allows the fiction to be read by more people. And that's been one of the exciting things of this experience is it's being read by more people, not just in the general public, but in people in the height of power than many of my nonfiction books.
Well, you mentioned the concept of useful fiction, and of course, for an author, fiction is particularly useful when it sells books for the author. And I can tell from the models that you're citing, Arthur Conan Doyle and George Martin, the Game of Thrones, that you've set the bar high. You wanted the book to be read by a lot of people, and I know it's been very successful. But when you started the process of actually writing a novel, did you find you were suddenly using all sorts of muscles that you'd never used before? Because yes, it's true that in fiction you can do things quickly that you don't have to justify them in the same way as nonfiction. But on the other hand, it's very hard to write good fiction. It's hard to write good dialogue. It's hard to write characters who are believable. And I'm a thriller aficionado, and one of the things that annoys me is that very often the thrillers that are pacey and exciting and page turners have these flat characters, and the writing itself is awful. It's really quite rare that you get a thriller that's really well read. So how did you and your co-author make this jump from nonfiction writing, which is, you know, argumentative and has an argument that runs through it, to the different kind of style that you need to make a novel that really reads well?
Sure, and I should add the co-author on it, August Cole. He's from our world as well. He's not a ghostwriter or a fiction writer. He was the defense journalist for the Wall Street Journal. So he comes out of this space as well and works at a think tank now called the Atlantic Council in the U.S. I think you hit it right. A couple of the challenges of this definitely dialogue. So when you're writing nonfiction, dialogue's easy. If you're being accurate. Now some writers have problems with that, but you basically take the quote and you put it in. With fiction, you know, you're responsible for the quotes. And so dialogue is sometimes hard to write, and even that would be a really lame thing for a character to say. The bigger challenge for us, I felt, was not in the creation process, but in the editing process. So you become, the characters are literally your creations, and it becomes like, you know, children, you love them all, and if your editor says, well, you need to cut this one, you know, how could you? The other thing is fiction, I feel like, is a little bit more subjective in the exchange of what works and what doesn't, because some people like cliffhangers. Other people think cliffhangers manipulate the reader. Some people, you know, like the outlandish. Other people don't. One of the more fun reviews was someone who said they loved the space pirate scenes, but didn't think the idea of U.S. and China going to war was realistic. Okay. And I should add that reviewer was it wasn't a literature reviewer. It was a Policy World reviewer. So, but what the edit, so you have that subjective, but for us, it was also the framing of the book, again, was to frame the kind of books we like, but also to be useful. So by following multiple characters rather than one, it's also making a point of how conflict in the 21st century, and particularly conflict between states, would be different than the kind of conflicts we've grown used to against non-state actors like the Taliban, the ISISs, and the like, and that it would play out in multiple domains. So not just on the land, but also we'd see battles in the air, battles at sea, which we haven't seen, essentially for 70 years. We'd also see battles in two new domains we didn't fight back in the last world wars, in space and cyberspace. But so the result of that is that you're in multiple locations, and it has that style of like Game of Thrones or Red Storm Rising or Winds of War. These are all, or World War Z would all be fictional examples. But it also means it becomes like a, I don't know if the game's popular here, Jenga, where if you make one slight alteration, you cut a couple of sentences or a scene and one scene, something happens or doesn't happen in the battle in cyberspace, it has ramifications 50 pages later and what plays out with your naval ships at sea, do they have access to GPS or not? And so the edits became just really, really difficult in that balancing act. And the way, I would put it is there's kind of a military parallel of there's so many different moving parts in a successful operation that's multi-domain. And that's very different. One last thing that I would add in the believability part. We also can use the book to poke holes at the things that we accept in reality that make no sense. So, as an example, and I'm not revealing too much of the book, one of the early scenes there, there's a pilot who's complaining about the gun on the Joint Strike Fighter not working. Now, if
That sounds like a problem.
well, if you're in our defense policy world, one, it allows you to know that it means the book is not set today because it actually has a gun. Because in reality, it'll be about 4 years before it has a gun. So we've spent over $1 trillion on the program ultimately, and we still haven't even gotten a working gun. Now, our editor is not a defense policy editor, and he said, "That's crazy. That's absurd. Why would nations like ours spend so much money on a plane where the gun doesn't even work?" We didn't have the heart to tell him that right now in the real world, the bombs don't fit into the bomb bay doors. So these are the kind of odd things we accept in our world, and we use the book to show a, okay, when push comes to shove, what does this mean? Or for example, the same plane. I can beat up on Joint Strike Fighter all day long, and that's not why I came down to Australia. What does it mean to go to war with a plane where roughly 80% of the microchips in it are made in China and Taiwan? And that is everything from it raises interesting logistics questions that are different than what we would have experienced in the wars of today or back in World War II, to it raises a whole new level of not just cyber software threat, but a hardware hack of your major weapon systems. For the science fiction fans, it opens up the possibilities of the opening scene from Battlestar Galactica happening in reality.
Let me come back to cyber, but let me first ask you about the premise of the book. And the premise of the book is state-on-state conflict between great powers. And as you say, that's not something we've seen for 70 years. And in fact, we haven't seen much state-on-state conflict. During the Cold War, the conflicts that occurred were at the peripheries. They were not in the center of the international system. The last 15 years have been about US-led coalitions against insurgents and terrorists and so on. What you're postulating is something much larger, much scarier, much more dangerous. That is a hot conflict between nuclear weapons states. So,
How likely is it, do you think, that we're going to see a conflict like that in the next half century?
I certainly don't think it is inevitable. I would, as an aside, note that China's official government newspaper said, quote, a U.S.-China war is inevitable, end quote, and then went on to add, if the U.S. didn't change its policies in the Pacific. And of course, we're not planning on changing our policies in the Pacific. So I don't think it is inevitable, but this is an illustration of how what was once thinkable, the 20th century, as you well put it, was shaped by great power conflict, two actual world wars that cost tens of millions of lives, and one great power conflict that fortunately never turned hot, but it shaped everything from geopolitics to how we understand sporting competitions. And again, I'd point to how are we thinking about sporting, not just geopolitics, but sporting competitions. We now measure our medal count in the U.S., for example, not so much against the old Soviet Union, but against China. And you can see the same thing out here.
We still measure our success against the Brits, actually. So we're a bit further back.
Is this
you.
Where I'm not supposed to talk about the ashes or whatever?
Yeah. The Cold War didn't affect the ashes much. But anyway, go
okay,
on.
So... A war between states was thinkable. Unfortunately, in the Cold War, it didn't happen. And then it becomes unthinkable during this period of first, you know, we called it post-Cold War, and then it became post 9/11 in Iraq and Afghanistan. There was a famous professor, Steven Pinker, who wrote an article, the New York Times just 4 years ago, had an article that basically argued that the era of war between states was over. And the article was entitled, if I remember the quote exactly, Wars Gone Out of Style. If only it would. And so we've seen the return of great power tension, competition in Europe, after Russian land grabs in Ukraine and a constant stream of bombers with red stars on them visiting American and NATO's borders, we're at the height of alert that we haven't seen since the mid-1980s, the height of the Cold War. In the Pacific, there's no other way to describe it. The U.S., China, and our allies, we're engaged in an arms race. We've seen China buy, build, more warships, more warplanes than any other nation in 2012, in 2013, in 2014, planning to do so 2015, 2016. You get the picture. Where in turn, we've launched a new strategy to, as they call it, offset China with a new generation of high technology. You're seeing tensions at play. So the point is, I don't think it's inevitable, but it is now thinkable the way it was unthinkable, and it could be, you know, again, look back at history. Wars between states start sometimes through a deliberate set of choices, other times through crisis that's been out of control. So the same thing, if you're looking forward at the risk of war, it could start, you know, two warships scraping paint over some reef that isn't even on a nautical chart, or two planes bumping together by accident. That could never happen. Or it could be a set of deliberate choices to reorder geopolitics. Say, for example, in the 2020s when China's Navy is on pace to match not just in quantity, but quality. So again, I don't think it's inevitable. I also don't think the value of the book is only in if that scenario happens. You know, so for example, one of the storylines follows an insurgency, and it's basically playing with the idea of what will happen next in insurgency, but also what are the ethical and political issues of it. And the way we get at that is your perspective on the insurgency is you follow from the insurgent side, and so it raises these really kind of difficult, you have empathy when they're using tactics that we now have seen against us, and we say, you know, that's not right. Well, maybe, you know, what happens when the script gets flipped?
What about, to go back to your scenarios of planes bumping against each other or grey-hulled or white-hulled vessels ramming each other and taking some paint off,
How confident are you that we have the protocols and the relationships in place between powers like the United States and China to stop a local mistake or miscalculation like that from escalating into a much larger, more dangerous, potentially nuclear conflict?
It's a great question, and they are building some of these protocols and in many ways trying to mirror the ones that they had with the Soviets during the Cold War, but we're nowhere near the level that we had then. And you gave a couple of good examples of this, of, for example, protocols behavior at sea. There's things that are, frankly, not just unacceptable under, you know, the norms of how you operate at sea in general, but incredibly dangerous. And the U.S. Navy and the old Soviet Navy were able to figure these out. And then let me add, again, to the you know, we can say, oh, well, the Cold War stayed cold, so we shouldn't worry here. There were actually, even with those protocols, an incredible series of near misses, some of which we knew about at the time, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Other times, we only knew about after the fact. So there was, for example, this episode where a Soviet submarine essentially scraped the bottom of an American aircraft carrier, and they were both packing nuclear weapons. And fortunately, it neither exploded, but you could imagine if they had, you know, the world would have gone to war. Or there was a war game exercise in 1983 that the Soviets nearly interpreted as the start of the war. So the point is also, nuclear weapons don't provide the fire break that sometimes we like to think they would. So you don't have, we're kind of building those up, but it's complicated as well by new areas of competition. In many ways, at sea, it may be what we're kind of most troubled by right now, but it may be the easiest. What about things like cyberspace? So as an example, we in the U.S. have, and you in Australia, are basically, we've been, we're the victim, we're the target of a wide variety of cyber threats and attacks. And we've had to try and figure out how are we going to react to these different kinds of attacks, and which ones are okay and which ones are not, and how do we communicate back to China which ones are okay and which ones are not, and how do we respond. So weirdly, for example, it's where we're ending up, not okay to hack and steal secrets from our businesses, okay to steal secrets from our government, like all our classified security clearances. So we've when they've attacked American companies, we've reacted
like
very.
Sony.
Sony. But we pointed the finger at a different nation.
Right.
But I would use it more. There's five Chinese officers under indictment in Pennsylvania for attacks on like solar energy companies and the like. Now they'll never set foot in Pennsylvania, but you know, we said this is not right because you were stealing trade secrets to privilege your companies in kind of unfair business practices. So you're using your military intelligence apparatus to steal secrets, and that's not fair according to the world trade rules of the game. But when you got into our Office of Personnel Management and stole security clearances, shame on us. What I'm getting at is the norms that we built up during the Cold War was no attacks could happen, but everything would be targeted if we went to war. We may now have the opposite, where some attack, because of the cyber realm of this, some attacks are, we don't want them to happen, but they're allowed, but some targets have to be off limits. So either it's the, you know, I use the example of the economic side. We're probably not going to win that argument with China, but I think both sides do need to come to agreement. Things like, hey, don't get into things like nuclear command and control. Don't get into things like critical infrastructure, power plants, because that's too easy to go back to the novel. That's too easy to misinterpret as the opening stage of an actual cyber war. So when you're getting in that, it's not you're stealing my secrets. This I'm going to interpret as an actual attack, and so stay out of those areas.
Let me ask you.
But let me add just one thing. Incredibly hard to communicate. They had a ministerial between top American and Chinese leaders this summer. They met for a week. Cybersecurity was the top of the list. The only agreement they could come to, fisheries.
Let me ask you, we often hear, we're often told about cyber attacks that emanate, you know, principally from China, but also, as you allude, from North Korea and from other sources. How different is what a country like China does from what a country like the United States does? In other words, are we being hypocritical by constantly criticizing the Chinese for engaging in warfare that or kind of behavior that we that we engage in? Or do you think they do something qualitatively different and worse in the way they behave in the cyber realm from the way we behave?
Well, let's be sure to start off by saying that the term Five Eyes includes actors beyond just the United States. Mm-hmm. Another way of saying, you know, Mr. Snowden revealed things not just about what we do.
Sure.
I was at Fort Meade, and we don't use that name to call me he who shall not be named. The difference used is it a qualitative? It's actually it's a quantitative difference, and it's a difference in terms of who's advantaged by it. So one of the things that while the people in the intelligence communities here and in London and in places like Fort Meade, the NSA, they obviously should be greatly angered by some of the things that have gotten out, and then we can have a debate about, you know, was it right or wrong or the like. But also, it revealed they're doing something, they're best in class qualitatively. Amazing things that have been done. And actually, in the book, we use those examples, though, to warn how things that they have done are now out in the wild for others to do back at us that other parts of our government are vulnerable to. And the idea of having footnotes for the novel, so there's a scene where, for example, another intelligence agency headquarters building gets hacked, an American one, different from the NSA. And I actually briefed that scene standing in that place. But the point is, another reason for the endnotes, or down here it's an E version, so it's a rollover link, is that I can link to where that's been reported, so no one can say I revealed something classified. It's already out there in the wild for anyone to do. So they're doing amazing qualitative work. China, it's more quantitative. It's the approach of the, you know, massive cyber militia. Again, one of the characters is a Chinese university student, and the targets that have been hit are so incredibly widespread. And it's not, you know, inventing new things like Stuxnet. It's more, you know, kind of taking advantage of very basic flaws, things that we should have shored up ourselves. So you've got that. The other, I'd go back to what I said before. Yes, we definitely engage in espionage, and they engage in espionage, but there's not the privileging of, it's not feeding into economic competition. So it's not, for example, we've seen, you know, I use the defense contractor one. That's probably, I think we could, you know, we may not like that it's being, the program got targeted, but that's kind of par for the course. That happens in the world of espionage. It's more things that range from energy companies in U.S. and Australia that have been targeted to soft drink companies that are engaging in a negotiation. They're stealing not the design for something, but negotiating strategy when they're competing with a Chinese company. And so you have this link up between state government, military apparatus, and private business that's different than what we have here. And then it raises a question of, you know, by the rules of the game, which rules of the game do we care about, the espionage rules of the game or the world trade rules of the game?
Seeing as you mentioned Mr. Snowden and you gave me an opening, do you think that Edward Snowden is a traitor who used his position, his trusted position within the intelligence apparatus of his country, and thereby
let hostile intelligence services steal the crown jewels of US intelligence? Or do you think that he's a patriot who revealed an overweening element of the US intelligence services that and allied intelligence services that those of us in democracy should be concerned about?
So Snowden took roughly 1.4 million files. Now, as an aside, first, it's a good illustration of how even the NSA, best in class, at the time, it did not have the cybersecurity procedures that a good bakery should have. And by that, I mean things like, for example, he didn't point and click and pull in 1.4 million times collecting files. He brought in outside software that did it for him. So, if we're thinking, you're doing cybersecurity for the Lowy Institute, someone should, an alarm should go off when someone brings in outside software. Also, an anomaly, someone is touching 1.4 million files. Is this normal behavior or is it an anomaly? And then let's go talk to them and maybe they're doing it because their boss told them to, or maybe it's something off. The same reason, your email, suddenly you start sending files to addresses in Belarus at 2 a.m., someone in the IT department should, call you up and say, hey, are you intending to do this or not?
So Peter knows a lot about my email behavior, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I'm wondering about that visit to Fort Meade, Peter, that you had. But anyway, go on.
So the first is the cybersecurity is a tough, tough issue. But, we can even learn from this episode about how there's basic measures that would go a long way to protect ourselves. And I think that's important because I know in Australia right now we're having a various cybersecurity review and it's on the minds of a lot of corporations and like. Okay, so 1.4 million files. The result then is that he gathered and then in essence now are being released so many different types of information, so many different stories. And so the answer to you is that I bucket that those 1.4 million files or the stories that have come out so far into three kind of buckets, and then they answer kind of what he is. So one, he revealed that our intelligence services are carrying out espionage against our current or likely enemies. So they were, going after terrorist cell phone communication to they were hacking Chinese military communication networks. Surprise. That's actually, I would put that bucket as that's strategic behavior. Second bucket is bucket of questionable. And this is the debate in the United States of mass surveillance, mass collection, monitoring, however you want to say it, on mass scale, and as a result, touching not just your intended target, I want that terrorist communication, but millions of other people's communications. And that's the debate in the U.S. over privacy, Fourth Amendment. Third bucket, kindly I would describe it as unstrategic, meanly I would describe it as stupid. And that's going after, for example, communications of close allied foreign government leaders, NATO leaders, with the idea of whatever value you got out of that was not going to be worth the consequences of it going public. So the answer is, he's actually, how you think about him is whatever bucket you care most about. So the people who call him traitor, they always talk about bucket number one. He revealed all of these things and aided a China, a Russia, a terrorist, and the like. The people that say he's whistleblower, typically in the U.S., focus on bucket number two and sort of say he prompted a debate and a series of reforms that probably haven't gone too far, but basically we're not having this debate without him, so he's a classic whistleblower. The problem is, and the third one is just terrible, I just gave you a long-winded answer. Why can't he be both? And in American history, there's a figure, Benedict Arnold. Benedict Arnold, America is not a nation without him. He was one of our greatest generals in our Revolutionary War. He won the crucial battle that against the British that
the Battle of Saratoga, and he's our greatest traitor in history because about a year later, he cooperated with the British. He's both. And so in my mind, Snowden has illustrated both of these elements.
So if he walked in now, you'd punch him in the face and pat him on the back?
I would do maybe pat him on the back and then try and do a citizen's arrest.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an opportunity for you to ask Peter some questions. I have some more questions that I'd like to put to him, but I want to give everybody an opportunity, or some people an opportunity, whoever's quick with their hands. I saw the gentleman in the back first. Please wait for the microphone, and if you could keep it to a brief question. Thank you, Richard.
A brief question indeed. Richard Bronowski, I'm president of the Australian Institute of International Affairs in New South Wales. You mentioned the F-35. It's been getting very bad press lately, and I wonder if you could comment from an informed position. Recently, the pilot of a 1980s vintage F-16 shat all over that plane in a dogfight. And it was slow, it didn't have energy, it was fat. And the Navy love it because it's a kind of an aerial Aegis-class destroyer, but no one else does. Should we be justified in spending millions and billions of dollars on such an aircraft?
So, thank you. So, it seemed like I beat up on the F-35. I actually think it is, it's a valuable system. I do think I can speak for the U.S. It's a different question for Australia. I can weigh in, but, it's going to be an outsider suit. But for the U.S., one, I do think we should move forward with a buy. I think we're also kidding ourselves if we think we're going to get as much advantage from it as has been, it's kind of been overpromised. So it is needed. It will be useful, but it has certainly been overpromised. And second, we're kidding ourselves in thinking that we're going to buy as many of them and at the supposed price all the way into the future that we have baked into our assumptions. So in the U.S., for example, we're telling ourselves that we're going to still be buying the first generation F-35 into the 2030s. And that I don't see as viable. Second issue that you brought up is this episode where essentially in a simulated dogfight, it did poorly against an F-16, which is a 40-year-old aircraft. The makers of it and the program office on the military side pushed back at that and said, yeah, okay, it's not so good at dogfighting, but it won't have to because it's going to have great sensors, so it'll see the bad guy before they get a chance to shoot. And second, it's stealthy, so they'll never even see it to shoot back. The problem, and this is not just an F-35 problem, it's a problem across a series of military systems, and we use Ghost Fleet to illustrate this, is that we have a lot of best day planning, best day assumptions. So in Ghost Fleet, we play with the idea of, well, what would happen if, for example, you were called upon to do close air support in an F-35? We say we're not planning on it, but what if? Maybe it could happen. Or what if you got into a dogfight? We're not planning on it, but what if? Or what if, for example, the enemy had a vote? Happens in normal wars, the enemy had the ability to jam your sensors or knock down certain systems. Or what if you were flying a stealthy system that, got dinged up because it's operating in an austere airfield, or it turns out not to be as stealthy as you planned because the assumptions were from the 1990s. Will that hold true in the 2020s? And it's, again, that's not just an F-35 problem. We have the same problem across a series of our kind of military systems that we're buying today. So in the U.S., for example, we're buying a new warship. It's deployed out to the Pacific, the littoral combat ship. The Navy's own tester, not Peter Singer's words, the Navy's own tester described that it would not be survivable in a high-intensity battle. We similarly are buying a tanker, and I believe Australia is buying the same tanker that is designed only to operate up to a medium intensity environment. So in the book, we play out what if you happen to be the captain of a ship that's not designed to be survivable in a battle that gets into a battle? Or what if we had a conflict that wasn't a medium threat, but was a high-end threat, like we would see in an Asia-Pacific conflict. So the point is, there's a lot of best case planning going on, and that's what sets you up for a fall, not merely kind of what you buy.
Thank you. This gentleman here.
Thank you. Our book club just finished the latest Philby biography, and the conclusion I drew from that was that the British, and I suspect the CIA, would have been better off for 25 years just sitting in their offices having tea than actually practicing intelligence, which is completely counterproductive for those 25-odd years. What level of sophistication and benefit does modern-day intelligence really have?
But, you know, on behalf of the intelligence professionals, their complaint is always, you know, our mistakes are the ones that get aired. We get no credit for all the incredible things that we did in secret. And since we've revealed Cold War files, there's a lot of amazing things that they did during that period. So moving forward, we have, what does intelligence provide today? It provides a level of information that, frankly, back then people couldn't even dream of. So the ability to pull out a single individual's communications from tens of millions of communication documents to you and the U.S., we fly drones, so you can have 24/7 monitoring of an individual target. You can not just identify that single individual, you can identify whether in a crowd of people carrying AK-47s, who fired their AK-47 by the heat going off the barrel. I mean, these are amazing things. In turn, you and I also have amazing intelligence capabilities. So for the book, for example, you know, our nonfiction style research was meeting with the real world people who would be in such a war, the jet fighter pilots, the ship captains, the Chinese generals, the billionaire tech executives. But also it involved, you know, what I would call intelligence analysis. So where we're trying in the book, you know, we talk about the next generation of Chinese aircraft carriers and how it will be equipped. How did we do that for the book? People in China have taken selfies of themselves in Chinese harbors, and in the background, the aircraft carrier is under construction. You can marry that up with Google Earth photos. You can then figure out the dimensions of it by the size of known objects, and then figure out the size of unknown objects. So, for example, you can go, this is the size of the elevator on the aircraft carrier, and then you can go, aha, it will fit this kind of jet fighter and not that kind of jet fighter. So I know in the year 2022, when this ship gets out there, it's going to have these aircraft and not that aircraft. It means I and you have the capability to gather intelligence in a way that you could only dream back in the Cold War. It also is opening up challenges for states because everything's out in the open, but also the truth is harder to find. So everything's out in the open. I think there's a great link to Australian concerns. The shoot down of the Malaysian airliner over Ukraine. People online were able to document the Russian role in that within a matter of hours. On the other hand, there's these literal, we call them troll factories, basically people employed by the Russian government to go out and kind of muddy the waters online. So the Wikipedia page for that is like this battleground of conspiracy theories. So that, you know, that so things are out there, but the truth is harder to find. And we play with that in the book of, again, I'm not revealing too much of it, but the one of the early battles is selfied, so to speak, a young man films it with a smartphone and pops it up online before the president knows that the nation's at war. Sounds sci-fi. Well, the bin Laden raid, the most secretive raid in the last, you know, 15 years, it was live tweeted by a guy in Abbottabad. So that's this nature of secrets is changing, and it presents, you know, opportunities and challenges for the intelligence community.
Tom Arnold in the front row. There's a mic, yes.
Hi, Tom Arnold. I'm a visitor from Ireland, where I'm Director General of the Institute of International and European Affairs. What risk do you attribute to Chinese policy in the South China Sea over the next decade as a potential flashpoint for conflict?
I think there's great risk in a number of ways. So one is trying to rewrite the accepted norms or the accepted rules of the game, the accepted laws. It's also reflecting essentially, I'm trying to, when we look at the artificial islands phenomena, it's trying to create facts on the ground, kind of fait accompli. You can see how hard it is to react to that. And look, you know, those islands are not yet fully, it's going to sound like the Death Star, fully armed and operational. They very easily, some have been, and the others very easily could be. And then you've got not just bases, but a kind of how we thought of Great Britain during World War II, unsinkable aircraft carriers. So there's a lot of trying to create facts on the ground. It also relates to not how the U.S. and China interact, but how China interacts with its neighbors. And, you know, whether it's these episodes to, you know, you mentioned white painted ships that are really warships muscling their way. There's a lot of my perspective as an American kind of muscling of regional neighbors, weaker neighbors, again, trying to rewrite the rules of the game. It creates a lot of opportunity for crisis, for misperception, for conflict, and not just necessarily that one that sparks, but then the ripple effects of it. So again, not revealing too much of the book, but you know, it specifies how there's these kind of dust-ups between China and the Philippines that the U.S. Navy intervenes to kind of keep it from turning hot. That sounds like that could never happen. But the book is set 5 years after that. And so much like, now we get kind of history wonky, that same, there was a series of crises between Great Britain and Germany and France in the kind of 1900s, the Morocco crises and the like, that created, they set the stage for the 1914 war starting and changed how the nations looked at each other. I worry not just about, you know, what happens in South China Sea, but how does it affect broader? So you've got that playing out. But again, don't just focus on the questions of what happens specifically in the South China Sea. The big change here, you know, globally is China's becoming a global power, and it's a natural phenomenon. It's a global economy. It's also global political power. It's becoming a global military power. And a good illustration of this that kind of caught Americans by surprise was, and it kind of illustrates how we operate differently, Libya. So you have the Libyan crisis. You know, we can argue a humanitarian disaster looming, but we and with our NATO partners carry out airstrikes. That's one thing America, we're really good at doing airstrikes, and not good at leading to a functional state after airstrikes. But that's how we operate in Libya. What's interesting is China sent warships that evacuated 50,000 Chinese citizens from Libya. And that's interesting in two ways. It's one, China's ability to deploy warships all the way around the world. But secondly, that they had 50,000 citizens on the ground just in Libya. And that's, again, you know, I don't think our perceptions, this is a work of fiction, I don't think our perceptions of current reality mirror that. And same thing of our perceptions of China and the U.S., you know, I don't know if it's the phenomenon here, but in the U.S., you know, we talk about communist China. It's a nation that produced more billionaires than anyone else, that sells more Mercedes Maybachs than any other nation. And oh, by the way, it has defense companies on the stock market that they had to chill trading of that's very different. You know, that Mao didn't write about that in the Little Red Book. And so, you know, we need to match our reality to not just where is China headed, but where is it already right now?
Let me follow up and ask you, I mean, how prepared and interested are US administrations going to be in really turning their mind to the different kind of challenge that China poses, which is not a cold, not necessarily...
I, for one, believe President Trump will solve all of these problems. That was a preemptive strike before the Trump question.
Well, I haven't mentioned President Trump, even though you were so impolite to mention the ashes. I haven't mentioned Donald Trump. But let's leave aside Donald Trump. I mean, is America really, how focused is America likely to be on China? I mean, how can you be tough with Russia and China at the same time? I mean, America has so many calls on its attention. It's the global superpower. Everyone in the world wants it to be doing something in their part of the world. It faces really serious security challenges. Even when President Obama announced the rebalance, the truth is that most experts in Asia would say that the rebalance, you know, the pivot's run out of puff. That sure, there are changes, but it hasn't delivered on the rhetoric. So is there another possibility that the United States doesn't follow through with the rebalance, kicks the China challenge into the long grass, and focuses on challenges that may not be as important as China, but are more urgent?
I think you hit it on the last part of it. And again, this is an American issue, but I would, again, as an outsider, I would argue it's also an Australian issue. And I'm not putting this in the obviousness of the China challenge, however you frame it, you know, both a trading partner, but also a strategic competitor, you know, a place that you're looking for how to, you know, keep my economy humming, but also, oh, by the way, I'm scared by the fact that you've just developed fifth generation fighter jets. I'm getting at something at a larger level, which is that essentially since the Cold War ended, we manage our inbox. We've not exercised strategic muscles for roughly our generation. And when I say strategic muscles, it's everything from how we think about geopolitics and how we follow through on it. When I say we, it's everything from academia to our parliament and Congress. Thinking not in terms of, you know, tomorrow's vote, but, you know, go back to how during the Cold War that this decision will have consequences 5 years from now. The multiplicity of issue areas that came into that. So, you know, whether it's military deployments to technologic investment in education, schools. So, you know, the difference of a great power conflict is not just multi-domain. For 70 years, Australian U.S. strategy, and frankly, it's also an economic strategy, but not just military, our assumption is that we'd be a generation ahead of the other side in technology, whether it's a business competition or a military competition. That's not the case now and won't be the case in the future. And part of, you know, this connects to everything from the question of what weapons we buy to how do we train in our schools, where we in both the U.S. and Australia have a STEM gap, a science and technology gap. We particularly have a cybersecurity gap. We talked about this as a new area. There's not enough human capital to go around, both for government but also for business. So what I'm getting at is there's all these to how do we think about deterrence theory? We haven't thought about deterrence theory in kind of a sophisticated manner, again, for a generation. You can see this reflected in the kind of poor ways we talk about it, whether it's vis-a-vis China or we think about it in cybersecurity. So there's these, what I'm getting at is I think there's a demand on us to try and stop servicing the inbox, and we're going to have to pull back, think big. And if we don't, that's how we set ourselves up for a fall. And that's where future historians will look back and kind of scratch their head and go, you know, what were you thinking? And to give, you know, a Commonwealth parallel, It's how, you know, you go back and read the periods of what Great Britain is doing in the Boer Wars, and you're like, you know, hey, there's something bigger happening in Europe right now. Or, you know, even in 1939, World War II is already on, and Great Britain and France are already at war with Germany, and yet they're talking about whether they should start a war with Russia. And you're like, this is not, you know, there's these kind of unstrategic thinking in history, and that's how nations set themselves up for a fall. I worry about that for us and our allies. And so it's on us, particularly in this space, to force the conversation, to carry out the research, to do the kind of communication that allows us to think big again.
It's a good moment to end. There are other questioners I didn't get to. It's been a fascinating discussion and one that we could continue for another hour. I certainly have got some ideas out of this. I'm going to propose to my chairman a series of novels by Institute staff members. I think Anthony Bubalo, My Travels in the Middle East, should be first off the rank. But the book that is actually on sale now, unlike the forthcoming Institute novels, is Ghost Fleet by P.W. Singer and August Cole. Now, where, Peter, can people listening, where can they buy it? Where should they go to?
It's available. So here it's available through a company called Canelo, and it should be on everything from iTunes to Amazon.com, not Amazon.au and the like. You can also, it's an e-reader, so wherever e-versions are available. You can also learn more about the book at ghostfleetbook.com.
He's got the full cyber workup for this novel. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Peter Singer. Let me say, Peter, that when the Donald is elected president, we look forward to receiving your application to be an asylum seeker at the Institute, and I'm happy to stand referee.
I think you'll have a true immigration crisis if that happens, yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. We hope to see you back soon. If you're interested in securing your seat at future events like this, please talk to the staff on the way out about becoming a member of the supporters circle or a member of the Institute. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.